usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of just like absolute clinical precision.
Oh, yeah, completely.
Right. It's like engineering. You break your arm, the x-ray shows that that jagged white line right through the bone, and the doctor just points at it and says, you know, there it is. That's your problem.
It's entirely binary. Like, the bone is broken or it is not. The tumor is there or it is. I mean, we find this immense comfort in things that are visible, things that can be neatly categorized and, you know, physically manipulated.
Exactly. But then you step into the world of human psychology, you try to look at the soul, at how our character is actually built on the inside, and suddenly that x-ray machine is just, it's completely useless.
Right, because we're staring at an inner landscape that is entirely invisible.
Yeah. And yet this invisible architecture dictates absolutely everything we do. It dictates what we can survive, what breaks us, and, well, what we eventually become.
Which is exactly why the text we're looking at today is so extraordinary. So we were exploring a treatise called On Dreams and Prophecies, or in the original Arabic, Al-Manamat wal-Nubuwa.
And I should say, welcome, if you're listening, to part one of a really special two-part deep dive. The author is the great Iranian philosopher and Quran commentator, Allamah Tabatabai, and that's pronounced A-L-A-A-M-E.
Yes, A-L-A-A-M-E.
Right. And what is absolutely staggering to me is the context of this whole thing, because he wrote this text in the city of Najaf, back in October of 1931. He finished it at dawn on a Saturday morning, and he was 28 years old.
I mean, to possess that level of synthetic philosophical vision at 28 is, it's genuinely difficult to comprehend.
It's absurd.
It really is. He is pulling from centuries of Islamic philosophy, theology, mysticism, and he's forging it into this hyper-precise, almost mechanical explanation of human nature.
Which is our whole mission today, right? Yeah. We're working from a fresh English translation of his original Arabic text, and we're going to unpack his framework. We're going to look at how a human soul is actually constructed.
Brick by brick.
Yeah. But before we get into the heavy philosophical lifting, I want to set a scene for you. Because Allamah opens with a hypothetical that completely changes how we think about physical reality.
The soldiers.
Right. The two soldiers. Picture two men, two soldiers walking onto the exact same battlefield. They're wearing identical heavy armor. They're carrying the exact same swords.
Same training, too?
Exactly. They've been through the exact same grueling, bone-breaking physical training. So by every single physical metric, these two men are absolute equals.
On paper, their biological and physical stats are identical. They have the same, you know, muscle density, the same lung capacity, all of that.
Right. Now, the first man is what Allamah calls the strong man. And he's a powerful, highly capable fighter. And his motivation makes perfect evolutionary sense, really. He wants to win.
Naturally.
Because winning means he gets to live. And living means he gets to go home, enjoy the spoils of his victory, and just continue his life. It's a very logical, survival-based motivation.
It's the baseline biological imperative. You know, survive the threat, acquire the resources, enjoy the outcome.
But the second man, he operates on a totally different operating system. Allamah calls him the brave man. And the brave man holds this conviction, like deep in his very bones, that there is no life worth living that is joined to disgrace.
Wow.
Yeah. To him, yielding the road to a destroyer or bowing down to an enemy is literally worse than death. He wants honor above survival. Like, he doesn't even want to survive if surviving costs him his dignity.
So their internal invisible landscapes are completely different, even though their physical realities are identical.
Yes. And watch what happens when the battle actually starts. The swords clash, the dust kicks up, and, you know, the wounds start coming. The strong man fights incredibly well right up until the exact moment a shadow of real imminent death falls across him.
When it gets too real.
Right. When the blood loss gets too high, or when the fight simply stops looking like a winning bet, something inside the strong man quietly does the math. The cost-benefit analysis shifts, and he quits. He yields, or he runs.
Because if his ultimate goal is survival, and the fighting is now actively guaranteeing his death, the fighting must stop. The physical action is subordinated to the internal goal.
But look at the brave man. He takes the exact same physical wounds, the exact same crushing exhaustion, the exact same blinding pain, and he takes them, as Allamah says, unto bitter death itself, and he just keeps going.
He doesn't stop.
He does not stop. They have the same muscles. They have the same blades, but they have a completely different physical limit. And I have to push back on this a little because as a modern reader, my instinct is to say, well, wait. Muscles fail when they run out of ATP. blood loss causes fainting. How does an invisible conviction literally change physiological stamina?
That is the brilliance of Alima's observation here. He is not saying the brave man becomes immortal or, like, immune to biology.
No.
He's saying that the threshold of what you can physically do is governed by what you deeply know to be worth it. What's fascinating here is that the difference between these two soldiers is not in their muscles. It is in their knowledge.
The knowledge changes the limit.
Exactly. The strong man knows that life is the highest good, so his actions max out when life is threatened. The brave man knows that honor is the highest good, so his actions push right past the boundary of his own physical survival.
It's a bizarre physics of conviction. Your actual capacity to act in the physical world is bottlenecked by your internal knowledge.
Yes. This core idea that our physical reality and our actions are entirely subordinate to our internal invisible knowledge is the single thread we're going to pull on today. And if we pull on it hard enough, it's going to unspool into an understanding of magic and miracles and the highest states of human consciousness.
Which brings up a really hilarious but also profound paradox about the text itself, because this book is literally titled On Dreams and Prophecies. So naturally, you pick it up expecting a book about dreams.
That would be the logical assumption, yes.
Right. But for 3/4 of the entire length of this book, Alima flatly, stubbornly refuses to even discuss dreams. I mean, before he gives you a single sentence on what a dream actually is, he spends chapter after chapter explaining how an ordinary, average human being is assembled.
Day by day, out of nothing but their own repeated acts.
Yeah. Why does he do that?
There is a deeply causal reason for this delay. To Alima, the spectacular, mind-bending things that a human soul can do, like prophecy or magic or seeing the future in a dream, they aren't separate magical departments bolted onto human nature that break the rules of reality.
They aren't anomalies.
No. They are the exact same machine as the ordinary human soul, just run at a much higher setting. You cannot understand the anomaly without understanding the baseline.
Okay, let's unpack this. It's kind of like trying to explain how a massive supercomputer can run a real-time simulation of a galaxy, but someone stops you and says, no, before we talk about the galaxy, you have to explain what a basic microchip is.
Right, you have to know what a transistor does.
Exactly. We have to look at the hardware first. You can't possibly understand the anomaly of a prophet or a sorcerer until you understand the baseline mechanics of a regular person.
You have to build the machine first before you can switch it on and watch it do the impossible.
So, what is this baseline hardware? Let's look at how things in nature reach their completion. Because Alima starts with this really foundational claim about the difference between us and the rest of the natural universe.
He observes the natural world and notes that things reach their completeness in entirely different ways. Some things are completely finished the exact moment they pop into existence. A rock, for instance.
A rock is just a rock.
Right. A rock doesn't have a potential future self it needs to work toward. But other things only reach their completeness gradually.
Like a seed.
Precisely. A seed is not a tree. A seed is essentially a tree's appointment with the future. It has to keep that appointment one stage, one day, one cause at a time. It requires water, it requires soil, time. It achieves its completion gradually.
And Alima argues that a human being is the ultimate, most extreme example of the second category. We are the only creatures that are emphatically not finished at birth.
Think about the animal kingdom. When a horse is born, it's a horse. It knows how to stand up within minutes. When a bee emerges, it arrives completely knowing, in its very biology, everything it will ever need to do to be a perfect bee. It doesn't need to learn.
It arrives complete.
Yes.
But humans arrive as a mere possibility. We are born completely unfinished. And what separates us from the horse and the bee is this capacity we have to know things fully and abstractly. But we're born with just the barest, tiniest seed of this capacity. It has to accrue to us gradually. We are an animal that has to literally make the rest of itself by knowing.
Alima is very precise about this. He states that his entire project here is to examine, and I'll quote the text directly here, what supervenes upon man insofar as he is one brought to completion through knowledge?
Let me just say that again, slowly. What supervenes upon a man insofar as he is one brought to completion through knowledge? I want to linger on that for a second because it shifts everything. Imagine a fenced-off plot of land with bulldozers, dirt, and scaffolding. When you look at that, you don't say, look at that finished building. You say, that is a construction site where a building is going to be.
Right.
For you listening, you are a construction site. You aren't a finished thing that is simply walking around passively having experiences. You are an unfinished thing being actively structurally completed by what you come to know. Every experience is a physical brick being laid on the side of your soul.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, if we grasp that the soul is a built object, a constructed architecture, it sets up the mechanics for where the soul can eventually go. Because Alame introduces this idea that reality is not flat. It has depth. It has floors.
Right. He talks about the dimensions beneath and above our normal physical senses.
Exactly. Underneath the ordinary, dense material world that our physical senses report to us, Alame says there is another, subtler world. He calls it the world of image. In Arabic, the mithal, and that's pronounced mithal.
Yes.
He describes the mithal as a very real, objective plane of existence containing vivid forms that have shape, color, and dimension, but they do not have dense physical matter.
Kind of like a blueprint that has precise lines and dimensions, but no actual physical weight, or like the environments you experience in a really hyper-lucid dream.
Yes. And then, above even the mithal, he posits a world of pure light, the world of intellect, a world with no shapes, no limitation, and no boundaries at all. He calls it, of all the worlds, the most complete. And we need to keep these two upper floors, the world of image and the world of pure light, in our minds. Because if your soul is an unfinished construction site building itself upwards, understanding its day-to-day mechanics is the only way to explain how it will eventually travel to these upper floors.
Okay, so if we are a construction site, what are the bricks? How does the actual building happen on a random Tuesday afternoon? How do we go from being a blank slate to having a fully formed character?
This is where Alame introduces the machine's first moving part. And the beauty of it lies in its absolute brutal simplicity. Let me read how he defines the base mechanic. He says, every sensible act that takes place has some impress upon the soul.
Every single act, not just the big life-altering decisions, not just who you marry or what career you choose, every time you speak, every time you choose to look away, every time you hit snooze on your alarm, every micro-action leaves a faint print.
There are two fundamental laws of human architecture at play here. The first is that every act leaves this faint, almost imperceptible mark. But the second law is where character is actually formed. Repetition deepens the print until it becomes permanent. If you do a thing once, it's a scratch in the dirt. The wind could blow it away tomorrow. But if you do it 100 times, 1,000 times, that scratch is carved into a deep, inescapable groove. And eventually, your soul just falls into that groove without you even consciously thinking about it.
And he has a very specific technical term for this finished, permanent groove. He calls it a malaka. That's pronounced M-A-L-A-K-A. It translates roughly to a habitus, or a deeply settled disposition.
It's the tipping point where an action goes from being a conscious choice to being an innate part of your nature. He defines a malaka as the firmly rooted form from which the act issues with ease.
Issues with ease. Okay, think about when you first learn to drive a car. When you're 16, getting behind the wheel is terrifying. You have the radio off, you're gripping the steering wheel so hard, your knuckles are white, you're sweating over the gas pedal, the brake, checking the rearview mirror.
Every single micro movement is a heavy, conscious decision.
Exactly. It takes up 100% of your mental bandwidth just to keep the car between the lines.
Because you are actively, painfully carving the groove. The dirt is resisting the shovel.
Right. But cut to 10 years later. You pull into your driveway after work, you put the car in park, and you realize with a sudden jolt that you have absolutely zero memory of the last 20 minutes of your commute. You navigated heavy traffic, you stopped at red lights, you made complex left turns across lanes, all while thinking about a work email. How did you do that? You didn't do it. Your soul built a malaka. The driving issued with ease from a firmly rooted form.
And Alame is making a staggering point by applying this mechanic universally. He's saying that your entire moral and psychological character, whether you are profoundly courageous or a coward, generous or greedy, honest or a liar, is exactly this driving analogy and nothing more.
Right.
You do not possess a prepackaged, static soul that then sits back and decides how to act. Your repeated acts are the soul you end up with. You are the sum total of your grooves.
But wait, I have to stop you there. Because if every single sensible act leaves an impress, we're doing things constantly. All day long, we are bombarded with sensory input. Why do some things carve a deep, permanent groove while other things just slide right off us?
Alame anticipates this exact problem. His answer comes down to a concept we can translate as strangeness or novelty. As human beings, we are fundamentally biologically built to hunt for causes. When something is deeply familiar to us, when it's settled and already filed away in our mental cabinets, it just slides past our consciousness. It becomes invisible.
We feel no itch to investigate it because we already possess the knowledge of what it is.
But when something is new.
When it breaks a pattern.
Yes, when it breaks the pattern, when it's strange, Alma says it must needs search out its cause. The sheer strangeness of the anomaly physically seizes us. It forces the mind to lock on, to process, and therefore to print the experience hard onto the fabric of the soul.
He has this beautiful, almost heartbreaking observation about this. He writes that the worth of a blessing is known after its loss. While you have your health or your youth or loved ones sitting across the room from you every evening, they are familiar. They are part of the reliable background furniture of your reality. Because they are constant, they become invisible. But the moment you lose them, their sudden absence is violently strange.
It's the strangeness of the empty chair, the sudden anomaly of silence where a voice used to be.
Exactly. The strangeness forces you to finally see what was there all along. It forces you to attend to it. It's the exact same reason that a pleasure or an achievement you had to toil and bleed for feels so much sharper and more real than something that was simply handed to you on a silver platter. The toil made the reward strange, and the strangeness forced you to attend to it.
And you just used the magic word that unlocks this entire section of his philosophy, attend.
Right, because underneath the physical act, underneath the strangeness, there is a master labor that runs this entire human machine.
Alma argues that the real ultimate mechanism of soul building isn't the physical act itself. It is attention. The Arabic word is tawaju, pronounced tawaju. It means the soul's active turning toward an object or an ideal. The strength of any piece of knowledge, the depth of any groove in your character, is governed exactly and entirely by the intensity of the tawaju you pay to it. Knowledge only lives or dies based on the soul's turning toward.
Let's unpack some of his analogies for this, because they instantly make sense of something so abstract. Imagine you run your hand very quickly over a row of different fabrics on a table, silk, burlap, rough cotton. If you do it in one fast, sweeping motion, you feel almost nothing, just a blur of friction.
Right.
But if you stop your hand, rest it entirely on the silk, and just dwell on it, you let your attention sink down into the nerve endings of your fingertips. Suddenly, the texture grows incredibly vivid. You feel the temperature, the microscopic weave, the slight resistance. The fabric didn't change. The physical structure of your hand didn't change. The only thing that changed was the localized density of your attention.
Uses another brilliant example about standing in a loud, crowded room. Imagine a party where 50 people are talking at once. Biologically, your eardrums are physically receiving the acoustic sound waves of every single conversation in that room with equal force. It's a chaotic, deafening din.
A nightmare.
Exactly. But then you lock eyes with the friend standing right in front of you and you zero in on their voice. Instantly, the other 49 voices blur into a single meaningless wash of background static, and you hear your friend perfectly clearly.
And my absolute favorite one, he talks about a sick man in severe physical pain. The man is lying in bed, genuinely suffering, but then a close friend comes over and engages him in a deep, fascinating, emotionally gripping conversation. For an hour, the sick man is completely absorbed. He laughs, he argues, he tells stories, and for that hour, he barely feels his pain. But the absolute second the friend leaves, the conversation ends and the door clicks shut. The pain comes flooding back in like a tidal wave. Now, I can hear a skeptic saying, well, the brain just released endorphins that blocked the pain receptors. But Alma's point is deeper than the neurochemistry, isn't it?
Absolutely. Because even if we explain the neurochemistry, we still have to ask why the brain released those chemicals at that exact moment. Alma's proof is undeniable. Nothing structural in the sick man's body changed when the door closed. The tissue was still damaged. The nerves were still firing the exact same gamut signals to the brain. The only thing that moved was his tawaju. His attention moved away from the external conversation and turned back inward toward his physical body.
The pain only exists as an experience when the soul turns toward it.
This raises an important question for part two. If the focused attention of an ordinary person can literally tune out physical agony, or isolate a single voice in a chaotic room. If attention is the actual hammer and chisel that builds the architecture of the soul, what happens when a prophet or a sorcerer points their attention at the fabric of reality itself?
It's a thrilling setup, but before we can watch a soul ascend to the upper floors, we have to deal with the basement. We have to answer a very dark question. If our acts and our attention are constantly carving these grooves into our souls, what happens when the grooves don't line up? What happens when they cross each other or contradict each other? This brings us to Alma's structural explanation for human misery. Why do we suffer?
To understand his theory of suffering, We first have to understand his definitions of pleasure and pain. He defines pleasure as a faculty of yours, getting what completes it.
So if I have a faculty of sight and my eye looks at a breathtaking mountain range, that faculty is getting what completes its nature. It delights in the beauty. The feeling of that completion is what we experience as pleasure.
Exactly. And pain is simply the reverse. Pain is a faculty being deprived of what completes it. If you're starving, your biological faculty of digestion is being deprived of the food it needs. It signals that deprivation, and we feel it as the pain of hunger. So far, this is very symmetrical and intuitive. But then, Alamed drops a philosophical twist that completely shatters our normal understanding of suffering.
I'm going to set this up, and I want you to read the exact quote, because it sounds crazy at first.
He writes, very definitively, pure pain has no existence whatever.
Pure pain has no existence whatever. Now, wait, hold on. If I accidentally put my hand on a glowing hot stove, my nervous system sends a very active, highly aggressive, positive signal to my brain, screaming at me to move my hand. The agony feels incredibly real. It feels like a positive force invading my body. How on earth can he claim that pain does not exist?
This is where we have to introduce this concept of the whole. Alame is arguing from a deep ontological perspective. Mm. He is saying that pain is not a substance. It is not a thing in its own right that possesses independent existence. It is purely an absence.
Like the concept of cold?
Precisely. Cold is not a physical substance you can capture and put in a jar. Cold is simply the word we use to describe the absence of heat. Heat is the actual measurable kinetic energy. Cold is the hole where the heat is missing. It's the same with darkness. Darkness isn't a shadowy fog that rolls into a room. Darkness is just the complete absence of photons. Light is the thing. Darkness is the lack of the thing.
So pleasure is the positive reality, the presence of completion. Pain is simply the empty hole where a pleasure or a completion was supposed to be. Pain is the vacuum.
And Alama follows this up with a very serious warning to the reader. He writes, this is a secret with secrets beneath it. Understand it well. And I'll just tease this for our listeners. In part two, this exact metaphysical logic that pain is a whole, not a substance, is going to be used to explain the ultimate nature of evil itself. Evil will be revealed not as a dark opposing force, but as a mere hole in the fabric of the good.
But if we accept that pain is just a hole, an absence of completion, it immediately begs the question, why is life so full of them? If we are naturally mechanically oriented toward pleasure and completion, why is suffering the universal baseline of the human condition?
And here is where Alama's brilliance really shines. His answer to human suffering is not a moralizing one. He doesn't say we suffer because the universe is punishing us or because we are fundamentally wicked. His answer is purely structural. He says we suffer because we are crowded.
Crowded. The Arabic term is tazahum, taziae, ahum, mutual crowding.
Tazahum. To understand this, you have to realize that you are not just one single, simple organism with one unified goal. You are a chaotic, screaming committee. You have the hungry animal faculty that desperately wants calories and comfort. You have the proud ego faculty that wants respect and status. You have the rational faculty that wants to sit in quiet contemplation. And every single one of these committee members is trapped inside one finite physical body, sharing a strict, non-negotiable allowance of 24 hours a day.
The committee is way too big for the conference room. Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's ground this in a very real modern example. It's midnight. You have a huge career-defining project due tomorrow. Your intellectual and ambitious faculties desperately want to stay up and finish it. They want the completion of success. But your biological faculty of sleep is screaming for rest. They are at war over the exact same midnight.
You cannot satisfy one without actively starving the other.
Exactly. If you stay up and finish the project, you get the pleasure of accomplishment, but you create a massive hole of physical exhaustion. If you shut your laptop and go to sleep, you get the pleasure of physical rest, but you create a gnawing hole of anxiety and unfulfilled ambition. That starvation, that constant grinding friction of having to choose, is the ache of human life.
Listen to how Alame frames this, because it reframes the entire human condition. He writes, had the acts of different faculties issued from one single faculty alone, no pain would have arisen there.
If we weren't divided, we wouldn't hurt.
Suffering is not a cosmic penalty. It is just the mechanical friction of a divided self. It's the grinding of gears when a complex machine is trying to pull in five different directions at once. And what that implies is incredibly profound. It means that the cure for human suffering is not and logically can never be just acquiring more stuff to feed the committee.
You can't outconsume Tazahum.
Right. If you have five dogs pulling a sled in five wildly different directions, throwing more meat to the dogs doesn't make the sled move forward. It just makes the dog stronger and the pulling more violent. The only cure for the friction is unifying the self, getting all the disparate faculties to align under one single ultimate aim.
And that leads perfectly into the tragic trap we fall into while trying to feed this chaotic committee. In our desperation to satisfy all these competing urges, we make a catastrophic categorization error. Alamed draws a stark line between a real good and a supposed good.
This is a crucial distinction. A real good is something that actually objectively completes one of your faculties. Water completes the faculty of thirst. Knowledge completes the intellect. Those are real goods.
But a supposed good is something else entirely. It is a mere means, an intermediary tool, that we mistakenly elevate in our minds into an end itself. We mistake the bridge for the destination. And Alame uses one of the most unforgettable parables I've ever read to illustrate this, the story of the miser in the desert.
It perfectly captures the madness of human desire.
Think about a gold coin. A piece of money, in reality, is nothing but a sheer intermediary. It has no intrinsic survival value. You cannot eat it. It will not keep you warm at night. It cannot quench your thirst. It's only valuable because it's an agreed-upon stepping stone to trade for food or a coat or shelter. But the miser forgets this. The miser's attention fastens onto the tool. He falls in love with the stepping stone itself. He hoards the metal discs as if they're the end goal of existence.
He polishes the means and entirely forgets what they were meant to acquire.
Now put that miser in a remote, utterly desolate, scorching hot desert. He's hundreds of miles from any merchant, any market, any other human being. He's starving, and his throat is completely parched. He is dying. And there, buried in the sand, he uncovers a treasure chest full of gold coins. To him, in his deeply ingrained delusion, he rejoices. He thinks he is saved. But the gold can buy him absolutely nothing in that desert.
He has acquired everything he spent his life training his soul to want, and he's going to die of thirst anyway. The supposed good has failed him completely.
Alamare writes about this delusion, comparing us to a man who finds a treasure in a remote and desolate desert. And then he delivers this brilliant punchline. He says that a single grain in the bird's eyes is grander of worth than a peerless pearl, because the grain of wheat is a real good to the bird. It provides actual nourishment. The pearl is a supposed good that will literally kill the miser while he holds it. We hoard the coin and starve in the desert. We polish the means and forget what it was for.
Which brings us to the ultimate burning question. If all these things, money, status, power, are just means, what is the end? What is the one real good that actually unifies the screaming committee?
If we have this divided self, this crowded room of faculties all demanding different things, something has to take charge to prevent the system from tearing itself apart. Something has to sit at the head of the table. Alamare writes that there must be something else which apportions to the faculties their acts, bounds them, and subdues them. This is the rational soul.
The rational soul is the core you that has the executive power to say yes or no to the committee. And whether your rational soul is strong and clear-sighted or weak and easily bribed by supposed goods determines the entire trajectory of your internal construction site.
And the way the rational soul navigates this chaos is by relentlessly following the chain of why. Let's walk you through this because it's a profoundly clarifying exercise. Take any action you did today and ask why. Let's say you went to work. Why? Well, to get a paycheck. Okay, why do you want the paycheck? To have money. Why do you want money? To buy a house, buy food, and have security. Why do you want security? So you can be at peace, free from anxiety, and live a good life.
It's an endless chain of four. You do A for B, you want B for C, you seek C for D.
But Alame says this chain cannot mathematically go on forever into infinity. It's impossible to have an infinite regression of four. Eventually, the chain must hit a wall. It must terminate in a bedrock answer that is unconditionally worth it in and of itself.
And this is where Alame reveals the ultimate destination of human psychology. He argues that when you trace every single human chain of why all the way to the very bottom, they all terminate in the exact same place. He calls it the absolute real. In the framework of Islamic theology and divine oneness, the Arabic term is Tawhid, pronounced Tawhid, God, the ultimate, unconditioned good. Every single four aims here.
And this leads to a quote that honestly forced me to put the book down and walk away for a minute. Let me read it slowly. He says, "Every act is true in reality. The false exists only by accident."
I know. It sounds like a complete paradox at first.
It does. Every act is true in reality. I have to play devil's advocate here. How on earth can every act be true? What about a thief? What about a murderer? What about someone who intentionally destroys another person's life out of spite? How can those acts possibly be described as true?
It sounds counterintuitive until you apply the chain of why to the perpetrator. Even the person doing something horribly, objectively wrong is at the very bottom of their internal chain of desires, reaching for the real good. They are aiming for the true light, but they have catastrophically miscalculated the application.
So take the thief. Why does a thief break into a house and steal? The thief steals for money. Why? For security, for joy, for freedom from the anxiety of poverty. Security, joy, and peace are real goods. So the thief's ultimate foundational desire is fundamentally true. The tragedy, the false accident, as Alma calls it, is that they have used a counterfeit, destructive means to try and grasp that real good.
Exactly. The core yearning is pure, the execution is corrupted, and from this profound empathy for human brokenness, Alma draws his most radical conclusion. He writes, "Every man is, by necessity and by innate nature, a confessor of the real."
I find that so incredibly moving. If you scratch any human desire deep enough, underneath all the scar tissue and the confusion, you will find a blind, desperate reach toward the one good.
We are all aiming at the exact same target. The only difference between us is our accuracy. And this is the moral pivot of the entire treatise. This is the fork in the road where human nature diverges.
Based on this exact dynamic of accuracy, Alma outlines three basic settings for the human soul. Let's walk through them. First, you have the complete felicitous one. In Arabic, the term is sada sa'ada. This is the soul that clearly sees the absolute real and consciously, deliberately says yes to it. They let the real order the chaotic committee.
This is the fully unified soul. The friction of the divided self is resolved because every faculty is serving the same ultimate goal.
Then, at the absolute opposite end of the spectrum, you have the complete wretch. The Arabic is shakoa shakoa. This is the soul that clearly sees the real, understands the true good, but deliberately, consciously refuses it, usually out of pride or an addiction to a supposed good. And the horrific trap of this state is that their own knowing becomes the internal witness against them.
And then, of course, you have the middle setting, in the measure of their knowledge of the real and their assent to it.
Right. Now, I want to pause here and offer a very crucial, explicit caveat. We have to be crystal clear about what Alma is doing here. He is not playing cosmic judge. He is not handing down divine verdicts on real people, pointing at this guy saying he's a wretch and that lady saying she's felicitous.
No, not at all. This is strictly a psychology of how a soul builds itself by its acts. It means the difference between a saint and a monster isn't their underlying nature. It's what they chose to do with the one thing they were both reaching for all along.
Which brings us to the culmination of today's deep dive. We've talked about how the machine works. We've talked about the master lever of attention, the painful friction of the divided self, and the ultimate target we're all aiming for. So what happens when you run this machine for a lifetime? Where do these built souls actually arrive?
Based on what we say yes or no to, our built souls arrive at different destinations. Alma sorts these into five distinct lives or ladders. And I want to reiterate, this is not a biological horoscope.
Right, the open road?
Exactly. Even those with difficult temperaments can climb by training. The road is completely open through practice. You can always take the shovel and carve a new groove.
So let's look at the ascent, the felicitous soul. What does that climb actually look like?
This is where we return to those upper floors. The unified soul stops being pulled apart by the heavy anchors of contradictory material desires, and it naturally begins to ascend. First, it returns to the world of image, the mythal. It perceives vivid forms directly, and Alma explicitly notes that it does this without any material pain.
The physical friction is gone.
Yes, and it ascends even further to the world of pure light. No hindrance, no multiplicity, no veils. Remember the crowding, the tazahun, the absolute agony of the divided self trying to share 24 hours.
Yeah, fighting over the midnight.
Well, the world of pure light is the structural cure for that crowding. Because in that world, nothing is physical, which means absolutely nothing is scarce. You don't have to choose between rest and ambition. You can have everything at once. The faculties no longer fight.
And at the very, very summit of this climb, there is a state that the mystical tradition calls fana, pronounced fa, N-A-A. It translates to annihilation. Now, that sounds terrifying to modern ears, but it's not the annihilation of you as an existing being. It's the annihilation of the noisy, crowded, defensive little ego that kept getting in the way of your vision.
It's the final dropping of the artificial barrier between you and reality.
And Alma gives an analogy for this final step that is just, it's a masterpiece. Let me read the quote. He says, "A person is like a man looking at something from behind many panes of glass. Whenever his eye fastens upon one of them, he sees not what lies beyond it."
This is such a profound insight into how our attention betrays us. Think about walking through a museum and looking at a priceless painting that's protected by a thick sheet of glass, or just looking out a window at a beautiful landscape. If you relax your focus and look through the glass, you see the landscape outside perfectly. But the moment your eye focuses on the glass itself, maybe you notice a smudge of dirt or a reflection of your own face. The landscape beyond instantly vanishes. It goes out of focus. The glass goes from being a transparent window to being an opaque wall.
Every supposed good, every beautiful thing in this finite world that you stop and stare at as an end in itself becomes a pane of glass. Your gaze fastens onto the money or the status, and it completely hides the absolute real that lies beyond it. Fauna is the moment you finally stop fastening on the panes, you let the glass be invisible, and you see the real directly.
And Alame has two incredible maxims about this climb. The first is, there is no nobility like farness of aspiration. How high you go is entirely dictated by how high you dare to aim. And the second maxim is the price of admission. He says it is the wrenching of the soul free from love of this world, which is the head of every sin.
The head of every sin. Because treating this finite world as your ultimate end makes you the miser in the desert.
Precisely. Which brings us to the tragic alternative, the descent. What happens to the wretched? What happens to the souls that refuse the real and fasten their gaze permanently onto the panes of glass?
They are ruled by raw appetite, anger, or most fascinatingly, jaw pronounced J-A-H, station rank or status.
The trap of status. Owning the reins of power becomes sweeter than any pleasure the power could buy. Controlling the kingdom beats enjoying it. Status is the last thing from which even the elect of the elect come pure.
And what is the prison they build? The treadmill of more. Alame says they live perpetually between regret and hope. Because they chase finite material things, their mind can always picture a better version.
Whatever they attain, they can conceive of something more and better than it. Mm. And because they can constantly conceive of the plus one, the soul recoils from what it does attain.
So what does this all mean? It means the treadmill of constantly upgrading the better house, the higher title, is literally the architecture of wretchedness, because you can never, ever rest. He says, wretched is the companion.
And just briefly, we should mention the deficient at the very bottom, those who have made ready nothing of any account on either side, and the vast middle mass, simple of opinion, living mostly by imitation. The Arabic is taklid, taklid. They hand the reins of big questions to experts, never quite cut off from the higher world, never quite free of the lower one.
Wow. Okay. We have covered an immense amount of ground. Let's pull the camera back and recap the fully assembled machine. You are the unfinished animal. You build yourself with acts, which harden into character, into a malaka. The master lever is your attention, your tawaju. We suffer because our divided self is crowded and we mistake the means for the ends. But underneath it all, we are reaching for the good. The choice is yours. Unify and be freed, or hop on the treadmill of more.
That's the architecture.
And notice that not a single word today has been about dreams or miracles. This has been about you, on an ordinary Tuesday, building yourself by what you repeat.
But now that we have the machine, what happens when we switch it on at full power? What happens when this unified soul slips into the world of image and sleep? How does a prophet's soul receive directly from the highest world? And how does his dark twin, the sorcerer, climb the same ladder in the opposite direction? That's what awaits us in part two.
I cannot wait. But before we go, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought. If Alame is right, that our attention literally builds the permanent architecture of our soul, and that staring at panes of glass keeps us from the real, what does it mean that we now live in an attention economy, spending hours every single day staring at literal glowing panes of glass? What kind of souls are we unintentionally building right now?
Something to deeply consider.
Thank you so much for joining us for part one. You are under construction today with this hour. Build well.